Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best you can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 9 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Richard, it has been quite a week. There's been a lot going on. It's been another big week of testing for students. But I tell you, I'm really excited about this week's podcast. Well, you know why I'm excited about this week's podcast, but people that are listening certainly don't know.
Right. Give them an explanation.
So, this week, as part of my work, I do a lot of different things. Like Dr. Richard, we are in the office most days, but we find ourselves having the opportunity to go to different schools, different facilities. And one of the things that I do that I really enjoy doing is I get to work as a psychological consultant for a juvenile commitment center. And so this week when I went to the center, I had an opportunity to talk with the facility administrator, Thomas. And Thomas just so happened to have listened to some of our podcasts from the past few weeks, and he had a lot of great questions, which we always like to hear, which we always like to talk about. So as Thomas and I were talking, we had this great idea that why don't we have Thomas on the pod and have him talk to us about some of his observations and how it relates to some of the things we've been talking about. And so Thomas is here. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you, Bernie. Appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, I think this is going to be great, and hopefully it's the first of many opportunities for you to be here with us, but also for others to share their expertise and their experiences with our listeners. And so our plan for today has sort of evolved over the last 24 hours. Dr. Richard and I had set and really talked about our discussion of the issue of zeros. And if we have time today, we'll get to that. But we kind of have a feeling that we will have enough to talk to Thomas about, and excited to share some of his stories with our listeners that we may not get to the zero discussion today. That may be once again saved until next week. Is that all right with you,
good
Richard?
Enough. Yep. Yep.
And good enough is good enough.
It has been in the past, should be in the future.
Fantastic. So so let's begin with just a little bit of introduction. Again, Thomas is the facility administrator of a juvenile commitment center in our area here in Central Florida. And he works with juveniles who have been committed to a program, but also has some pretty specific expectations or specific characteristics related to their abilities.
Correct.
So Thomas, tell us a little bit about the youth that you work with, and so that we have that as a reference point as we kind of have our discussion.
Sure. All the youth at our facility have been committed by a judge to be at our facility to complete treatment, which in hopes that once they complete treatment, they will, you know, change their lives, find a better way of, you know, handling problems, coping skills, things of that nature. There's a lot of these facilities across the state. What the Department of Juvenile Justice has done, though, is tried to specialize their programs to meet the needs of specific children. And our program is for a borderline developmentally delayed youth, classified youth. All of our youth have an IQ or have a full-scale IQ that has been done for them between 80 and 70.
Okay.
We've had lower come in, but mainly it's right in that borderline intellectual functioning range if you were, you know, going by a DSM criteria.
Okay. So all of these youth have IQs in that 70 range.
Right.
And in our field, Richard, of course, we refer to that, just as Thomas did, as borderline intellectual ability. Borderline intellectual ability ranges from 70 to 84 in that range, right? Right.
What we're talking about here is a score that's used typically used for IQ tests, and the average score is 100.
Right.
And the average range is from 85 to 115.
Correct, right.
And then, so what we're talking about are students who have IQs lower than average.
Correct.
But they're not considered intellectually impaired.
Right.
Because to be intellectually impaired, it has to be below 70.
Right.
So these are students who are somewhere in that area between having an average IQ and an intellectual impairment.
Right.
So it's safe, Thomas, it's safe to assume that these students also have difficulty mastering academic skills.
That's putting it lightly, yes.
Okay. Perfect. Yes. So we know the population we're talking about.
Correct.
Now, but you said they were also, they're there on a judge's order.
Correct.
So are these also students who have run into legal problems?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Significant legal histories. The state does an assessment which basically tries to predict their rate of risk. Is this a high-risk youth, a moderate-risk youth, a low-risk?
And when you say risk, risk for?
Reoffense or future criminal behavior.
Okay, future criminal behavior.
Correct.
Okay, good.
All right.
And one would assume that the more significant their previous charges, the higher risk they are for future.
Correct. But it's not just behavioral things they look at with the risk assessment. They look at substance abuse issues. They look at mental health issues. They look at family home issues. They look at the ability, if they have certain skills, like, you know, do they know how to, for instance, I'm just thinking of the risk assessment because I've done a lot of them.
Sure.
You know, do they know how to start a conversation properly? Do they know how to give a compliment? So it's basically a very holistic approach to trying to measure risk.
It sounds like some of that you're talking about are adaptive skills.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Can they manage on their own in the community or in interpersonal relationships, socially, and those kinds of things?
Right.
That's great. That's great that they look at those. And I don't think that most people would know that they even considered those things. So the youth that you work with are very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
They, just as a summary, they are typically borderline intellectual ability. What risk factor are they considered to be?
I'd say the majority of our youth are high risk or what they deem to be moderate high.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So moderate high to high risk youth with borderline intellectual ability. Mm-hmm. And in your program, and I certainly don't want to put you on the spot to where you have to give too many details about your program or anything, but my experience there is that these kids, you know, although they're living in a detention facility of sorts, many of the expectations placed upon them are typical expectations that we have on all youth.
Absolutely.
So they go to school every day.
Every day.
You have teachers that come to the facility to educate them there.
Yes. Our education is provided by a local school district.
Okay.
It isn't provided by the Department of Juvenile Justice or a state entity. It's actually a local school district.
Excellent.
So these residents, do we call them residents?
Yes.
Are in school every day. They're going to school every day at your facility.
Monday through Friday, every day. Through Friday. Normal school day. But they go year-round, too. There's no breaks.
Okay. There's no breaks. And obviously, where our discussion is going, just to tie in from previous week's discussion, is, Thomas, what do they also do that is typical of other students in other schools?
They do testing. They have to meet the, you know, core standards, state standards, or the sunshine standards or something like that. I don't know what they're called. I'm not an educator.
Sunshine state standards.
That's it.
Yes. SSS.
Yep.
Lots of S's there. So we have, in your facility, we have youth that are committed to a program that's, they're in a placement that's probably appropriate for them because they're moderate to high risk.
Mm-hmm.
They have some limitations to their intellectual ability. Yet they're in a program where many of the educational expectations upon them is the same as if they were at a regular public school.
Correct.
Okay. So they have to do testing. They have to go through various forms of assessments to figure out where their educational levels are.
Mm-hmm.
So as it relates to some of that, can you tell us just a little bit about the educational level of most of your students or what the typical student looks like?
Our youth come in, of course, that, you know, they have the borderline intellectual functioning, you know, diagnosis. And that is, they're usually given an IQ test prior to placement anywhere. It's basically what that, you know, that psychological assessment is used to determine what is the better placement for the youth. So they come in, and then once they come into the youth, you know, our mental health department will do testing, but then our education department will do testing as well. And what they'll do is they'll pull records from that youth's home school district, bring them in, find out what grade they're in, how many credits they have, when was the last time they went to school. They look at, you know, basically a whole school record. So behavior, everything is tied into that. Their IEP comes over if they have an IEP. And then they, once they do the testing, they figure out what grade they're in and then enroll them in school. A lot of our youth, for instance, I can think of one, he was 18 years old, was in the eighth grade. Mm-hmm. Majority of our youth are behind in school. I think the entire time we've been open, we've had one, maybe two, that were in the appropriate level for their age.
Okay.
Most of them performing academically lower than that actual grade level.
Okay, so they may be at an 8th grade level, but they're performing academically at a 4th or 5th grade level.
Correct. Their reading and then, you know, math skills are at that level.
Okay.
And so I'm assuming, given their cognitive abilities, which we know are below average, and their criminal history, that these are kids who haven't been either attending school regularly, or if they have been attending, they've been underperforming academically.
Correct.
Okay.
A majority of our kids, you know, are violating. They're already on probation. They're violating probation because they're not attending school.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they do go to school, you know, I've read so many comps, you know, comprehensive evaluations that, you know, excessive tardies, excessive absences, unexcused absences. And we're talking 20, 30, 50 in a school year.
Right. So it's safe to assume that despite a chronological age of 15, they may be functioning academically more like an elementary age child.
Absolutely.
Reading at a third or fourth grade reading level.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And you mentioned IEPs a few moments ago, and, you know, as part of my opportunity to work with some of the youth there, I've had a chance to read some of the same comprehensive exams, evaluation reports, and the majority of the IEPs tend to be more behaviorally related.
Absolutely.
And Richard, maybe, I know you know more about this as well, that there's this crack in education where, you know, if students fall on the left side of a 70 IQ, they are in the range of intellectually disabled, and so they can receive services, they can receive supports for their intellectual disability.
Right.
For students who are above 70, other expectations and requirements are necessary to receive academic interventions, services through an IEP, as a student with a learning disability or something like that. Where that crack lies tends to be in Thomas's youth's area, because those students between in the 70s, they're not low enough to be considered intellectually disabled,
right?
But usually their IQ isn't high enough to identify a learning disability, as we
to be considered learning disabled, you have to have an IQ in the average range. You have to have at least average intellectual abilities.
Right.
And these are kids who fall below that average level.
Right. So these students, and Thomas said it earlier, and I'm jumping the gun with it but it was such a great thing to say. He said these are the students who are left behind. When we talk about No Child Left Behind, these are the students who are left behind because these are the ones who don't have the attributes required to gain additional services, but at the same time, they're held to all the same expectations of everyone else.
Right.
So we have a situation like your 18-year-old who scores at an 8th grade level or is considered to be at an 8th grade level, but is functioning at a third or fourth or fifth grade level, but he's still taking the eighth grade state standards test and held to those expectations. Okay, very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the testing. And Thomas, you were telling us earlier that at your school or at the school at your facility, the students still take the same testing that everybody else takes.
Correct. In fact, 2 weeks ago, they just got done taking the used to be called the FCAT. Now it's, I don't know what it's
FSA.
Called. FSA testing, yes. So they just got doing that the week before last.
Okay. So they did the same thing that every other school does. The mm-hmm. students come in, they sit, and they take this test.
Mm-hmm.
On the computer?
I don't believe so. I think it was all hand or all by hand.
All paper pencil.
Yeah, paper pencil.
Okay. And, you know, you were telling us earlier about observations and observations that Richard and I have talked about as issues in previous podcasts. You know, we have students who aren't necessarily eager to test. Is that safe to say?
That's very safe to say, yes.
And so they may sit down and Christmas tree the test. They may just go through and randomly put marks down on the paper, but the teachers aren't allowed to say anything. It just happens.
Yep. I mean, you know, they get done with their test, they leave the room.
Okay. So when they finish the test, they get to leave the room and go back to probably some preferred activity, which would probably be anything except testing.
Right. Anything other than school.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And maybe that's sort of, as we're talking about this testing issue, and again, Thomas, not to put you on the spot, because there's lots of other things we want to talk about. These are not students who are eager about school.
No, they don't. Generally, I mean, this is a broad generalization, because I have had youth in the facility who have told me, you know, I want to get a high school diploma. I want to get a GED.
Sure.
But you get the feeling that they feel like that's what they're supposed to say.
Right.
Because, what's every parent, you know, you need to go to school, you need to get your, you know, every parent from almost any walk of life will say that. But then, you know, I've had a lot of kids who are just, I don't have an interest in school, I'm not good at school, I don't like school, all I do is get in trouble at school. You have all of those things.
Right. And many of these students, like students we see in some even public schools, would not hesitate to use a behavior to get out of school.
Correct.
Whether it's cursing the teacher, whether it's just getting up and leaving, whatever the case may be. So we have a situation, and I think what we're working to get at here, and to sort of the picture that we're trying to paint, is that we have students who are in a placement because of a set of circumstances, because of legal issues, because of intellectual attributes, who are in this placement, an appropriate placement for them, where they can hopefully gain some correctional support, some correctional changes for their lives, and yet the program that we're giving them educationally really doesn't change as from anything that they get in the regular public school.
Right.
So we know that these students are challenged for a variety of reasons. But really, what we're doing for them educationally isn't any different than what they would get anywhere else.
And it's a real interesting dichotomy in that, you know, our facility, our whole program that we have control over is geared towards this population. Behavior management system is geared towards this population. Our groups and treatment and, you know, all life skills, vocational skills is all geared towards this population. But the school cannot function, can't meet those kids where they are. You know, as mental health professionals, you know, you always want to meet, you know, the client, meet the person where they're at. But the school can't, because they have to meet the client at what the standard says they are.
Right.
Now, let's summarize this a little bit, make sure I understand exactly what we're talking about. So we have a situation here. How old are these students?
Average age, I'd say, range would be between 14 and 18.
Okay, so these are typical high school age students.
Yes.
Okay. We know they're behind academically.
Yes.
We know they have limited below average intellectual abilities.
Yes.
We know they've had high absentee rates.
Yes.
They're not interested in school. Mm-hmm. They have criminal history already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we put them into a place, but we make them take the same curriculum as if they were functioning in a regular public school. They were functioning normally in a regular public school.
Yes.
Okay. So that the system, I think for our listeners, this is an example of, because they have to pass this test, their education has to be structured a certain way.
Correct.
And you have no choice in that whatsoever. I mean, even though you know that it's not an appropriate educational program for them, nobody seems to be able to do anything about that.
Right. And, you know, our school, you know, they do their best to remediate the kids the best they can, get them up to a certain level. But we're talking, you know, if a kid's that far behind, they're at our program from 6 to 9 months generally.
Okay, now, there's another question, and I may be getting ahead of Dr. Burney's agenda here, but these students have to pass some test before they can graduate from high school.
Correct.
What are the chances that they're going to pass a test at a high school level?
Slim, I'd say.
So we have a situation where there's a group of kids here who are probably not going to get a high school diploma.
Correct.
A group of kids, some of which may not even be interested in getting a high school diploma.
And don't care whether they get a high school diploma.
Right, right.
And they can't take the GED until they're 18
right.
in Florida.
Okay. Right.
Well, at juvenile facilities, actually, they can take GED prep.
Okay.
Like they can, there's actually built into our education department, they can go on a GED track.
Okay.
But here's the problem. These, especially in my facility, now at other facilities where it's higher functioning kids, you know, they have no problems going through GED programs and prep. Our kids are so far behind, not just school-wise, but where they're at academically, where they function at, they literally can't understand the GED prep material to be able to take the GED.
So the GED really isn't a good option for them.
Not
a second option.
Not anymore, since the test has changed and it's even harder.
It's more difficult.
It's even harder than it used to be.
Yeah. Right, right. So we know we have a group of students here who are going to end up without a high school diploma, which means they're going to have trouble with employment.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, I just want to make sure I understand that.
But I think it's important to throw in here that, you know, a little bit about Thomas. You know, Thomas has a master's degree. He's a licensed mental health counselor.
Mm-hmm.
He's worked in juvenile facilities for
years.
Mm-hmm. So he understands this population. And that's why, again, I was so eager for him to come in and talk with us, because he lives this. You know, this is every day for him. For years, it's been every day for him. And, you know, some of the things that he was talking to me about in our discussion this week, I think is very salient to what we've been talking about, because here we have a situation where some alternative is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the things that we were talking about, Thomas, is the idea of vocation. You know, we have this, if we remain still talking about your youth,
okay.
We have a situation where, okay, the likelihood of these kids graduating high school, the majority of them graduating high school is very low.
Right.
So they're going to leave your facility without a high school diploma, even if they're 18 years old.
Right.
They'll leave your facility without a high school diploma, without a GED.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to go back to the homes where they live. And you know, without getting to the issue of recidivism or anything like that, the issue is that because the way that our education system, not your program, but the way the education system is set up, these kids are going to return without any skills that's going to help them dig out of the hole that they're in.
Right. Without a diploma, without a GED, and without vocational skills.
I would say the most our kids will get leaving our program is they might pick up a couple credits towards graduation.
Right.
I mean, granted, they're at the facility for 6 to 9 months. You're in eighth grade. You're not going to make up eighth to 12th grade in 6 months.
Sure, sure.
Know? So for a lot of our kids, because they're so far behind, it's almost an unrealistic expectation that they graduate in that window.
Sure, sure. And I know that at the facility you guys have mental health counselors that work directly, individually and in groups with the students or the youth, and they do a great job, and hopefully sort of guide them into the direction of making better choices and better decisions related to things. But when it comes to, and Richard, we've talked about this many times before, you know, the concern is that we are, whether it's after they leave Thomas's facility or after they leave high school, we have a large group, relatively large group of youth without the skills necessary to sustain themselves.
To be employed.
Right. They don't have employment skills. They don't have trade skills so that they can actually walk into a position where they can actually do something. You know, let alone that, you know, I will assume that many of your youth are as juveniles, but they have felonies. Which
multiple
creates
felonies.
Right, which creates problems of its own. You know, once you're a convicted felon, it's really difficult to get a job anyways. And so there are so many things stacked against some of these kids,
right?
That and they are, and I think that's important to, mm-hmm. to recognize. They are kids.
Yeah.
You know, sure, they made bad decisions, and again, not getting into areas that we could probably talk about for days. You know, they come from homes where it's not the most conducive to healthy development, and you know, you do everything that you can, either at your facility or in a regular school, and we're left with youth who enter adulthood with little to no skills for themselves to sustain themselves. So we have this sort of vocational abyss. And Thomas, you mentioned that when we were talking this week, that what we were talking about other countries and how
right.
how other places seem to do that seems to work right. well for their students.
Right. Well, no, one of the questions I had for Dr. Burney was, on the previous podcast, he talked about, you know, we have this assumption of equality.
Right.
And how, you know, everyone's equal or coming from the same place or same level, so we're going to treat everybody equal. And so my question on the inverse is that, is should we have the assumption that everyone should get a high school diploma? You know, it seems like that's the assumption the education system places on people, is you are going to get a high school diploma, you are going to get a GED. This is the first door that you have to walk through to be able to have a life, period.
Right. And I'm going to tell you, that was the question that you asked that made me think, okay, we got to get this on the pod, because that's a great question.
Well, you know, and that reminds me, we had this bill, No Child Left Behind law, which was, that's an aspirational goal.
Sure.
Right? The idea was that no child would be left behind. Well, here's a group of students. This is
right.
one group.
Right.
And the problem here is it's not the only group being left behind.
Right.
It's one group that's being left behind. But right now, No Child Left Behind is being discussed and reauthorized, mm-hmm. and it's going through the Senate and the Congress now, to presently. And the name is Every Child Ready for College or Career. Mm-hmm. And so again, it's an aspirational goal. In the House of Representatives, it's Success for All. So we're still clinging to this notion that everybody can be held to this standard.
Right.
That they're all going to graduate. But here you are telling us, mm-hmm. We're not preparing these kids
right.
for graduation or
right.
career.
Right. And, you know, in my world, you know, coming from, call it what it is, criminal justice system, you
right.
know, is, you know, a branch of it being juvenile justice. The Department of Juvenile Justice has seen that, you know, and they've allocated lots of funds for vocational training through different programs when kids get out, mm-hmm. and prevention services and things. But one of the problems we saw from my facility, now we're granted, you know, we're a very small facility in the cog that is juvenile justice, is that some of our kids, when they get placed in the they can't be placed in vocational services because they're not at what I was told, a reading level that can understand vocational manuals or vocational instruction. I mean, mm-hmm. do you want a kid who can't read the manual on how to operate the table saw operating the table saw?
Right.
Comes
right.
back to that.
So it's not a simple question of let's just put them in vocational training.
No.
There are also requirements there.
Absolutely.
Right. And you know, Richard, we've talked before about the old school idea of like apprenticeships
right.
and things like that. And, you know, certainly there are lots of different variations on the idea of vocational training, as opposed, you know, you don't have just the classroom-based learning, you have hands-on practical mm-hmm. experiences and stuff like that. But again, the actual use of those kinds of approaches to vocational training really doesn't happen all that often. And again, we have situations, you know, again, whether we use Thomas's facility or many other facilities as examples, we're left in a scenario where, because of certain attributes of the youth, they're not afforded some of those opportunities that could help them make some of the better decisions that we want. And you know, I have certainly heard delinquent youth before make statements like, you know, well, I don't know what I'm going to do when I get out of here. I'll probably just sell drugs. That's what they know. That's what they're going to go to because they haven't been taught anything else.
Right.
So we're in this perpetual cycle, and mm-hmm. of course, I think it's important maybe here at this point to say, you know, that much of the recidivism rates and stuff like that generally are going down. It's Absolutely. Getting much better.
Yeah.
Because especially here in the state of Florida, we're sort of shifting the way that our juvenile justice system works and how we're identifying students, and that the risk system you were talking about earlier has been helping. But maybe the next step that we need to take is this step to say, what are we doing with these students educationally mm-hmm. and training-wise? Mm-hmm. Maybe we're helping them not get in trouble again, or we're putting some systems in place to prevent them from having more legal problems. But what are we doing to get them out of, again, if we're just being very blunt and honest about it, what are we doing to get them out of poverty? What are we doing, which is the biggest risk factor for criminal behavior is poverty. Right. What are we doing to help them get themselves out of that?
Right.
So we have these issues, and going back to your fabulous question is, you know, are we working under this assumption, global assumption, that everybody should graduate high school? In my opinion, that is a poor assumption. I think it's a true assumption. I think we work under this fallacy that everybody should graduate high school. But as we've talked about before on the pod, certainly the purpose of high school originally was to prepare for college.
Right.
And clearly our legislation and our policies that have been written continue to promote that idea or that function of high school. But it's failing to recognize that there are youth students who will not go to college. And so what high school looks like to them should change.
Right.
So so that was a great question. And I think that I think it is something that has to change, because it is something that we, most people, hold to. You know, we just assume that when you graduate high school, the next step is college. We just assume that, even though we, as we've talked about before, 60% of high schoolers do not go to college. Mm-hmm. Not high school graduates, but 60% of high schoolers don't go to college. So what are they doing? Where are they going? And we need to provide some training for those guys. So anything else on that?
No, but what we're doing is, it sounds like what we're talking about is we have an educational program that's only preparing about 40% of the students who enter the high school system.
Right.
That we're not preparing the other 60%. And what we've been arguing over these weeks is that when you have high stakes tests and accountability and assessment, you're codifying this system where you are almost intentionally deleting 60%, because they're either not going to be interested or they're not going to pass the test.
Now, do you? This is a question that just came to me. It's not on the agenda, so I'm going to catch you off guard. So I'm preparing you for it.
Okay.
Before I ask,
I'll pull myself together.
What do you think has been the problem that has kept legislation from recognizing this?
Recognizing
that 60%, I mean, the statistics are very clear. 60% don't go to college. What is keeping our otherwise, we'll assume, intelligent legislators from recognizing what the statistics actually say, so that we can adjust the system to adjust our expectations to actually fit reality?
I think it's a common problem. Since the 1990s, education has become a political issue. I don't say it's politicized, mm-hmm. but it's become a political issue where educational decisions are being made by lawmakers, not by educators. And lawmakers tend to have this misconception that all students can learn.
Right.
And that all students will succeed if they're taught correctly and if they're taught enough that they will succeed. And so these aspirational laws like No Child Left Behind are based on that erroneous assumption. Because what educators know is that not all children are going to succeed.
And it continues to be perpetuated by Race to the Top.
That's right.
And some of the newer legislation that's coming out.
Right. The Obama administration has essentially renewed No Child Left Behind, because Race to the Top demanded In order to get Race to the Top funds, you had to have an assessment and accountability component built into your grant.
So it doubled down on it.
They did. They did. So there was, in fact, no change from No Child Left Behind to Race to the Top. And we have all the same ineffective programs are still in place.
Right, right. So it really is this aspirational...
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Maybe an aspirational delusion that everyone is capable. Mm-hmm. And what it comes down to is something that you and I talk about all the time. And that is that we're now then working under the assumption that if students can't do it, it's because they're not trying.
Either they're not trying or their teachers
somebody's not trying.
Or the school is ineffective.
Right.
And those are all erroneous assumptions.
And the data tend to demonstrate that it's erroneous assumptions.
Right.
We know that, I mean, even talking to some of the youth at Thomas's facility, I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with some of them individually. 90% of the ones that I talk to, I want to graduate high school, I want to go to college, you know, at least the lip service is there, at least, that mm-hmm. this is what they want to do, and maybe it's them just saying what they think we want to hear.
They've been I think, and this is my opinion, I have no facts to back this up, but I feel like we're programmed from the first time we step into a school, I'm going to graduate, I'm going to go to college.
Right.
Yes.
Well, that was always my assumption in school.
You know, I have a 16-year-old daughter. She plans to go to college. Mm-hmm. She has no idea how to get there. She has no idea what grades she's going to need, mm-hmm. what her GPA has to be, what her SAT score has to be, mm-hmm. how to make the applications, mm-hmm. how to begin the process. And she lives with us, and we're educated. I can't imagine what it's like for the kind of youth you're dealing with.
Right.
They couldn't possibly know how to accomplish that goal.
Right.
Even if they could.
And they don't know anyone who ever has.
That's right.
Exactly.
Nobody else in the family has done it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so you think about, much like we talked about last time with, you know, how do parents just intuitively know to put their children on a list for a magnet school or charter school, you know. This is not intuitive knowledge for most people.
Thank you for that, by the way. I'm getting my son signed up this week.
He's one.
He's one of them.
No, he's not even one. He's 9 months.
He's not even one yet. But it's true. You have to have some resources to help guide you along that path, or else you don't know.
That's right.
I mean, I remember my parents, you know, they did the best that they could, but neither of my parents really went to college. And so, you know, as I was going through it, I was one of the first to go through it. And we were trying to figure it out as we went. I was signing my daughter up yesterday for the SAT. And my mom was here at the office with me. And she said, you know, I remember trying to figure that out for you to take it.
Right.
Because she had no idea what to do and what to take with it and how to figure all that out. So I think that, you know, like Thomas said, you know, from the beginning, what is sort of just institutionalized is that, well, this is what you do. You progress mm-hmm. from elementary school
right.
to middle school to high school to college, and then something happens after that. And when you talk to most students, they really have no idea what happens after that. No. College is just the next educational level mm-hmm. after high school.
Grade 13.
Grade 13. That's the way we used to talk about it in high school. Mm-hmm. So the assumptions that we're working under, I think, are damaging. Mm-hmm. I think that it makes us sort of with blinders that we don't really think about or consider the fact that, you know, a large percentage of kids will not mm-hmm. Go to 13th grade. They will not go to college.
And not only are we failing to prepare them, but now we've created a system that really works against them.
Right.
I mean, it really is geared to work against them, because there's no way that they can succeed, not given the constraints of the system.
Right. We have created a system where if you don't meet these expectations,
that's right,
life will be much more difficult for you.
Right.
You know, you and I have talked about this a lot, and I think Thomas and I have even talked about this a lot, because we like to sit around and talk about these things. What was the high school diploma,
right,
you know, 20 years ago is now the associate's degree, if not the bachelor's degree.
Correct.
So a high school diploma, sure, it's necessary for, you know, most job applications ask about it and those kinds of things. You know, to get entry-level jobs nowadays, you really have to have a college degree because of that institutionalized assumption that you're gonna go to college. And this leads to another really great question that Thomas asked, and that is, when we have this assumption, is it creating a situation where if we don't go to college, that we're not going to be able to have skills necessary for life?
Right.
I don't know if you remember the question that you asked specifically, but it was a great question about how are we preparing youth for adulthood?
Right.
We really don't do it in high school.
Right.
Right? We're not teaching high schoolers. When I left high school, I didn't know how to do a checkbook.
No.
Now, I took calculus. Right. I took physics.
Right. Yeah.
And AP chemistry. So I knew how to do stoichiometry. I love that word. Stoichiometry. But I had no idea how to balance a checkbook.
Right.
I didn't know about paying bills and doing those kinds of things. I didn't know how I still have very little understanding of financing for getting a car. You know, that it's when they start putting numbers on papers, and it's like, what are you talking about?
When do we teach kids about credit?
Right.
The thing that makes you pass or fail life, you know?
Right.
None of us, and there's no course on it. There's no education on it, you know?
Well, because the high school curriculum is designed to prepare you for college.
Right.
You have to take algebra. You have to take biology.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take courses that are specifically designed for college.
Right.
College preparation.
So
regardless of what your plans are, what your skills are.
Exactly. So we're not doing anything really to prepare students, college-bound students or non-college-bound students. We're doing relatively little, if anything, to prepare these students for life.
Right.
And I was talking to a guy the other day who is a business owner here in Central Florida, and he says that he does not hire anybody unless they have some college experience. And he says exactly the same thing. He says, high schools don't prepare students to think in the way that I need somebody to think for my business. And, you know, there is some technical skills that are necessary for his type of work.
Yes.
But I think that that's a profound statement that, you know, you have to have some college to be hired with some places. Not that you need to have a degree in anything in particular. You know, you don't have to have an engineering degree or a computer science degree or anything like that to be able to work for him. You just have to have had enough experience, educational experience, at a high enough level to know how to think. And I think that that's, we pair those two things together, and they don't necessarily have to go together. We can teach people how to have, for a horrible way of saying it, we can teach better people how to have good thinking skills without necessarily pushing them through an educational system that you know, has them learning things that they'll never learn or never use anywhere else in life. So I think we have certainly created this monster, and we continue to perpetuate it with our expectations and with the way in which our system is functioning, and not at all creating a situation where students can recover. You know, students begin a path. You know, when a student is 14 years old, that's when it's decided, typically, that's when it's decided if a student's going to get a standard diploma or a special diploma at 14, which typically, for some of these students, is before they even enter high school. They could still be in eighth grade at 14 years old. And that's when the decision is made about whether or not they're going to get a standard or special diploma, especially if they have an IEP. That's how that's decided. Yet, even if it's decided that they're going to get a special diploma, standardized testing doesn't change. The expectations don't change. And now they are put into a track where they're still having to take certain classes, but we're not providing them with any life skills, providing them with any vocational skills so that when they get their quote-unquote special diploma, that they have something that they can draw upon as they enter adulthood. It's very, very disappointing and challenging situation, I think, for everybody. I think it's tough for schools. I think it's tough for parents and tough for students. So I think I went off there for just a little bit. I think it's Richard's fault because he's just sitting there looking at
I'll
me.
I'll take credit for it.
All right. Did we have anything else that we were going to talk about with any of this? We've gone for about 45 minutes now, and good stuff.
One of the Thomas, you're here. And sure. I'm glad you're here. Do you have any other questions or any other comments?
No, I mean, the thing about college, like my experience I got out of college was it like, I felt like college, yes, I got a degree in this or that, but college really taught me how to learn something. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that's probably the biggest skill that an employer would look for. Can this person learn what I need them to do?
Right.
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 That's what college, once you have a college degree, mm-hmm. that's kind of what you're saying, is that
right.
you have discipline, mm-hmm. you can do things that you don't really like to do,
right.
and you can finish jobs. Okay.
Right.
Well, one of the issues that I'd like to bring up again are the two A's, assessment and accountability.
Right.
Because the educational reform movement that we're in right now, that is dominated by high-stakes testing, came out of assessment and accountability. And recently, I think it was John Oliver,
mm-hmm. yes.
who had a wonderful one-hour mm-hmm. show about high-stakes testing. And during that, played a clip of George Bush saying, mm-hmm. we have to have, without consequences, we can't have accountability. That
right.
in education, we need accountability, but we can't have accountability unless we have consequences.
Right.
I think that was the large turn that is working against all of us right now, is that how do you define accountability? Mm-hmm. What are the consequences?
Right.
And so we have this assessment and accountability program. And we've had it since 2001. It's now 2015. And every study that's been done has said it hasn't led to mm-hmm. improving education or the status of kids in any way. In fact, we have established a system that is working against a large number, maybe 40 or 50% of the students that it's supposed to serve.
Right. And I think that if any of you listening have not seen the clip from John Oliver's show, I did put a link, the YouTube link, on our blog at thementalbreakdown.com.
I would encourage every parent mm-hmm. yeah. of every school-age child to watch it.
It's an HBO program, so there's a few choice words. He uses words in it that we can't use.
It hasn't been sanitized.
Yes,
it has not.
Get ready.
But it's raw, and I think it's very, very honest.
It's very informative.
And he did a nice job of pulling everything together. And Richard, I think what you're talking about, and it really kind of leads us into our discussion, what our discussion will be on zeros, is that what has happened is academics have turned behavioral. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to behaviorally modify students to learn. And you know, when it comes to behaviorism, which is a topic...
one of our favorites.
We could talk about for a long time, is that when it comes to behaviorism, we will admit that there are certain domains in which behaviorism is effective. It can work with certain things. Especially if you want to get a pigeon to peck a button. But when it comes to learning, when it comes to teaching a student algebra, you are not going to punish a student enough to make them learn algebra. Not every student, anyways. And what this, what our accountability system has done is it has applied a behavioral principle to educational attainment.
And I might add, based on fear.
Based upon fear, right?
Right.
I mean, if you don't do this,
these bad
this is what will happen.
Are going to happen to you.
And I think that shift is significant.
Right.
I think that is really what has led us down a path of problem, and kind of relates to, and we didn't put it together really at the time, but relates to some of the emailers that we got over the past couple
right.
of weeks. You know, how did we get to this situation, and what's really the problem? The real problem is that we're trying to behaviorally modify students to learn.
And when we talk about consequences and accountability, you said this often, Bernie, is that nobody's opposed to accountability. That's okay. But when we attach consequences to that, then we get into problems. Because what we're saying is we're going to set up a system where we're going to scare everybody to be successful.
Right.
I mean, that's what No Child Left Behind was designed to do. We're going to scare kids, their parents, their teachers, their schools, and their school boards and states to be so afraid that they will succeed.
Right.
And that's what the Texas Miracle was supposed to buy us, was we're gonna make this public and we're gonna show everybody who's failing. And so that experiment has failed. And the students that Thomas deals with every day, you're not going to scare them into motivation.
No.
You're not going to scare them into academic. No. It just doesn't work. That's not what they need.
It's not worse than their everyday life.
That's right.
That's right.
These kids are not going to be motivated by a fear of failure. They're not going, because they've been failing all their lives. They're not going to be motivated because they're not going to get a high school diploma or they might not pass a test. It just has no meaning to them.
No.
And it has no meaning to large numbers of students. But lawmakers simply don't realize that not every child is going to succeed.
Right.
And what do we do with those who don't?
And all of that is not the teacher's fault.
It's not
the administrator's fault. But, you know, again, this punishment system that we're using punishes them for this student. And so, again, we get into this, we have fallen down this rabbit hole that seems endless. Because what we're trying to, all we're trying to do is, just to continue the example, we're digging deeper to try to find the surface, we're not going to get there.
And doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome.
Somebody said. That's insanity. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, so that, I think, is where we're going to shift, maybe for the next podcast, to talk about zeros, because zeros, that is the epitome of punishment-based academic motivation. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to talk about that. Thomas, you had some great questions about the zero thing, because in our last pod, we mentioned that we were going to talk about zeros, and you had some great questions for that.
Thomas had questions about zeros?
He did.
And we didn't talk about them?
We didn't, because you wanted to talk about other stuff, like something.
I wish you could see my facial expression.
So we will talk about zeros next time, because I think it's very important, and you know, we've talked to some of our teacher friends about it, and they've raised good questions, and like I said, Thomas has raised good questions about it, and I think it's a discussion that needs to be had, because intuitively, it's confusing.
And just by way of preview, we have to stop giving zeros. We have to stop using zeros the way we're using them. So please tune into that next podcast. It'll be a good ride for everybody.
Cliffhanger. That's right. These are the post credit.
Will Thomas come back and talk about zeros?
If you want me to.
Okay. Sure.
Fantastic. Well, Thomas, thank you so much for coming in. I hope that we didn't put you too much on the spot with any of our questions or anything. It was great to hear your examples, because it is exactly what we've been talking about for weeks now. So thank you again. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for the work you do with those kids.
Yeah, it's tough work.
Front line, for sure.
Absolutely. So with that, I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
And we'll talk to you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.